The only school of pharmacy in Wisconsin is right here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. You've probably driven by or perhaps visited Rennebaum Hall, the home of the school. Back in the 1880s, when the school opened, classes were held on the fourth floor of South Hall on Bascom Hill. The lab was heated with a wood stove, but the other rooms were not heated at all. In his notes, Frederick Powers, the first dean of the school, wrote, "All test tubes or other apparatus which required cleaning had to be taken to the basement where there was a luxury of a sink." Things are a bit different today, thanks to Rennebaum Hall. The School of Pharmacy is a world-class leader in pharmacy education, research, and service in the pharmaceutical, social, and clinical sciences. It educates future pharmacists and scientists and provides professional development opportunities globally to practicing pharmacists in the pharmaceutical industry. Dean Jeanette Roberts did her undergraduate work at Albright College in Reading, Pennsylvania. She earned her PhD at the University of Minnesota, which is okay, and a master's in public health at the University of Utah, where she was on the faculty for 15 years before coming to UW-Madison. In 2003, she was named Dean of the School of Pharmacy, the first woman to hold the post. She continues to teach and to conduct research in herbal medicines and dietary supplements and on antioxidants in cancer chemo prevention. She's also an expert on the medicinal properties of, you're going to love this one, chocolate. And she advocates its use. Educating consumers about drugs, supplements, and fads is a subject Dean Roberts takes seriously. You may have heard her on public radio answering call-in questions or seen her at one of her presentations to campus and community groups. She's always informative and very gracious. She's also been a wonderful friend of the University of Wisconsin Foundation. I'd like to introduce my friend, Jeanette Roberts.
Thank you so much, Sandy. It's an absolute privilege to be here this afternoon with this august group of Badgers, Badger supporters, and I hope I don't disappoint. The presentation is going to sort of go from here to there and back, and hopefully of interest to all of you here today. So let's start with thinking about terminology, because we often get confused when talking about various aspects of pharmaceuticals. And so I always like to begin by some definitions. So you often hear about complementary and alternative medicine, singular, and that is a very broad umbrella of medical practices, including things like chiropractic, aromatherapy, acupuncture, on and on and on. And that's not what I'm going to be talking about today. But rather, complementary and alternative medicines, plural, which are really categorized broadly as the herbal medicines and other dietary supplements not from plant origin. So just to make sure we're on the same page with that. And there's a lot of other words that are used in this context that we have to be cautious about in terms of minimizing confusion. The herbal medicines, in particular, are often referred to as traditional or folk medicines, and that's often used in a negative sense of old-fashioned and untested and so forth. They're also referred to, again, as the complementary and alternative medicines, which tends to be used in terms of newfangled and untested and questionable. So you can't really have it both ways, but that's how it works. Of course, the umbrella term now is dietary supplements, and there's some issues with that that I'll discuss. And of course, herbal everything, medicines, preparations, remedies, you name it, and those words appear on various products. The medicinal plants or botanical medicines, kind of just drawing in different words for meaning plants. And then phyto is the Greek for plant. So you see phytopharmaceuticals, phyto this, phyto that, and it's all trying to be even bigger and more expansive words meaning the same thing. So in my view, however, these need to all be considered in the drug category. And that's not to imply 20 years of clinical trials or whatever, but really to bring the same level of respect and caution to the use of these herbal products that sometimes gets missed because they're natural. So that's kind of how one message that I like to portray is that we need to pay attention when we're using these herbal medicines as we would for any other medicine or drug product. So I think there's a lot of good points about the sort of complementary medicine movement, if you will, in general. There's definitely more of a sense of taking control of your own health, of your own therapeutic situation, making informed decisions based on solid information. So that's all good. It often provides an avenue of hope that other medical practices don't, and sometimes that's appropriate, sometimes it is not. Also, the view of maximizing our knowledge by looking around the world at the medical and pharmaceutical practices that go on everywhere and not thinking that our quote-unquote Western medicine has all the answers, because it clearly does not. The other feature that I always like about herbal medicines is the long history of using plants as medicines with undisputed biochemical activity. Now, that doesn't mean that it's ready to go on the shelf in the store, but it certainly gives us some level of confidence about using plants in this way. Unfortunately, the list of bad points is even longer than the list of good points. So just to be cautious, again, the idea of confusion reigns among not only consumers, but healthcare providers, I can assure you. There is still one of my pet peeves is the product quality and content situation that we still face, and I'll get back to that several times. There is more and more basic and clinical research, but not to the extent that we need it to be. And so we're basically experimenting on ourselves, which, you know, we can do that, but just as long as we know we're doing that. The lack of education and usable information for practitioners is troubling, and this is really an area where I had hoped that pharmacy would really step forward, and it has not as a profession, and I'm pushing that, so maybe we'll get a little better there. And there's certainly no lack of information to consumers and the general public. Just go Google any plant or whatever, and you know, millions of websites pop up. But I would argue that there is a lack of usable and valuable information about these products that leaves real holes in people's ability to make informed decisions. The dollar signs Sandy mentioned kind of across pharmaceuticals, and in the herbal medicine area alone, the U.S. has topped $20 billion, again with a B, in sales. And it's just an amazing growth industry, as he pointed out. Although things have slowed down a bit. It was the herbal medicine industry was growing at a rate of 50% per year. Unbelievable. And now it's down around 2-3%, some years negative. So we're, again, testing these things on ourselves, and sometimes they're working for us and we continue. Sometimes they're not, so we discontinue. So it's a really interesting sort of situation. But the problem is that when that much money is on the table and regulations are iffy, as I'll get back to in a moment, some people's table manners, so to speak, deteriorate, and companies do things that they shouldn't, and therefore we have a problem with quality and content. So it's all kind of wrapped up in the same bundle. And again, I really do relate most of the problems with the herbal medicine industry to the current regulatory situation that I'll explain in a bit, because it's important for everybody to know. So in terms of confusion, this is not unique to the herbal medicine industry, but this is one of my favorite cartoons that has across the top today's random medical news. I think we all feel that that's what we get. And then behind the reporter, who says, according to a report released today, and for those of you that can see it, there's just a series of wheels. And so you just flip the wheel for the condition of the day and the problem of the day and the treatment of the day. So in this case, coffee can cause depression in twins. Okay. But then again, tomorrow you just flip them around and you have completely different information, probably contradicting what we heard yesterday. And we all feel this as consumers of healthcare in general, I think. And it's, again, not unique to herbal medicines, but certainly there's enough confusion out there for all of us. Another point of confusion in this particular area is the forms that you will find various herbal medicines made into. So I don't know if you'd have a practice of just going to Whole Foods or a health food store and standing in front of these supplement aisles, but there's bottle after bottle after bottle after bottle, and how do you make decisions? Well, this is a slide representing a variety of forms of garlic, which I'll talk about in a bit as well. And you see the cloves and the spice powder and so forth that we're very familiar with. But then you'll also see a variety of capsules, tablets, some filled with oil-looking substances, some with ground-up green stuff. And so how do you make a decision if you do all the research and you think that garlic might be an interesting approach to controlling blood lipids, which it's most famous for? Great. So then you get to the store and you're faced with this. What do you do? Well, I can't tell you either because we don't have enough information on how these things are made. They're not tested appropriately and so forth. So it really is frustrating and another source of confusion to the consumer. The other feature that grows out of that is, I have to give you a chemical lesson. You'll have several chemical lessons today. The first is the principle of solvent extraction. So if you take echinacea, very popular purple coneflower, popular herbal medicine and general lovely garden plant, probably out in Arboretum. This is a very good place for me to be giving this talk, by the way. And so if you grind up the whole plant and turn it into a capsule or a tablet, you have one medicine. But if you make a tea, which is a water extraction, you're obviously going to be sucking out the water-soluble constituents and not other things. And that's a very, very different medicine than the whole plant. If you make a tincture, that's an alcohol-based extraction, you're going to get a different profile of chemicals extracted from that same plant material. And if you get into ointments, salves, and so forth, the very fat-soluble constituents are what you're going to end up with. So how can you say echinacea is good for something unless you have it all figured out, profiled, understand how the products are made, and are measured for the content of the active chemical constituents? So it's really kind of wacky, I must admit. So product quality and content is one of my major freak points. And the point is that these products can be highly variable. And there's some good reasons for that, and there's some really bad reasons for that. First of all, those gardeners in the room, or botanists, would, I think, agree with me that plant identification in the wild is not that easy of a thing. And very closely related plants can be toxic or medicinal. Look identical. Almost identical botanical names and so forth, but very, very different chemical profile. So if you're not very good at identifying your plants, be afraid. The other feature, though, if you switch to the more modern situation, where you see 55-gallon drums of dried green material showing up on the docks of L.A. or wherever, well, you really got to know what you're doing and have a full analytical profile behind you to know what you're working with. So anyway, it's just the identification of the material is a point of variability. However much the herbal industry doesn't like the word chemical, plants are little chemical factories, and they make a different profile of chemicals based on their environment. So the rainfall amount, the soil chemistry, the presence of herbivores or pathogens will cause the plant to respond in a certain way, make a whole different set of chemical constituents for its situation, perhaps, sometimes close, but sometimes not very close, And unless you're monitoring, standardizing, analyzing what the plant is making, you cannot say it's the same material or useful or whatever until you have that information. So it really does change the chemical makeup of the final product that you find on the shelves. The hardest one of all is the adulteration problem, that is the willful substitution of one thing for another, and the contamination that has been running rampant in this industry, unfortunately. Ginseng is a perfect example and a very local one. Wisconsin grows a lot of the world's ginseng, and it's a slow-growing plant. It takes 7 years, really, to mature, and so people don't want to wait, so they stick in something else that instead of the ginseng and make their products. Well, that's not really tolerable, in my view. Also, different parts of the plant can give you very different medicines. So the roots could contain something different than the leaves and flowers and so forth. And so if you don't know what part you're starting from, you're really, again, at a loss for what the final product might be. And I already mentioned that the different preparation methods can give you very different products. So we really need to get this figured out. So if we look at the origins of drugs historically, plants are by far the greatest source of direct pharmaceutical agents over the counter, or the source of model compounds that have then been modified into useful agents. So one of my points here is that those individuals who say, who completely disagree with herbal medicines as a source of something useful, I think are missing the point, because historically we have this wealth of information that plants do contain useful compounds that can be utilized in a reasonable way for human health. So the other sources of drugs historically has been microorganisms growing in importance, marine organisms, which is a really interesting subcategory, and even select number of animal-derived products are finding their way into pharmaceutical use. And so this whole collection of things is now more broadly termed natural products, or natural products research, to encompass all of these different sources from nature of one kind or another. So to bring home the point that plants are hugely important in the history of the pharmaceutical industry. About 25% of prescription drugs right now are plant natural products or derived semi-synthetically from something that was isolated from a plant. So even in the prescription drug area, very, very important and continues to be. Another 15% are a little bit further away chemically from what was isolated from the plant, but still based on that. So we're up to 40% of the current pharmaceutical agents used are very close or directly derived from a plant source. So, and then if you start looking at over-the-counter products, more than 50% of anything you pick up will have at least one plant-derived ingredient, usually more than one. So again, this notion that plants aren't interesting or useful for medicines is really misplaced. I can give you several examples. We got a lot of gardeners, and we're at the Arboretum, so this is kind of a test. But obviously, the beautiful foxglove plant, the source of digitoxin, the cardiac glycosides, digitalis glycosides that are used for cardiac failure, and have been in use as they are extracted from the plant for hundreds of years. The opium poppy, another example, the source of morphine and codeine, which of course have their downsides, but of great importance in pain control. This is a relative newcomer to the materia medica, if you like, and this is the it's the Taxus. I can't only think of the botanical name. It's the Pacific Yew tree, YEW. It's a little low-growing mini tree with the needles, as you can see. And this is the source of Taxol that has been so popular and so effective for initially breast cancer, but now ovarian and other cancers as well. and a real success story in the natural products area in terms of starting by extracting the Taxol from the plant, which kills the plants from the bark. So you strip the bark, you extract your Taxol, you kill the tree. Well, that's not really a good sustainable situation. So now the needles are used, a precursor is isolated and then chemically modified into the real drug. So that's a big success. And this is the Madagascar periwinkle, which grows all over the place. The stuff we have around our yards isn't terribly interesting medicinally, but in other parts of the world, it is. And this is the source for what are called the vinca alkaloids, which are also widely used, vincristin, vinblastin, in various types of cancer. So again, another example of chemically important prescription pharmaceuticals directly from a plant source. So I thought I'd take a moment to diverge and talk about the School of Pharmacy in terms of this stuff for a moment. And we've really had some amazing leadership throughout the history of the School of Pharmacy in this natural product sort of milieu. And it started with Dr. F.B. Power that Sandy mentioned, who was the first dean of the school that opened in 1883. And he was followed by Edward Kremers. And both of these guys were classically trained plant chemists, basically, and worked on all sorts of isolation of interesting compounds and so forth. And under Dr. Kremers, we established what was called the Pharmaceutical Experiment Station in 1913. There's actually interesting history before that. But Dr. Kremers started this medicinal plant garden, basically, at his home. It moved to Camp Randall briefly, and then was asked to relocate because athletics got so important. So interesting there. But basically, the real one, the big one, 40 acres or so, was out by Picnic Point and went for 20 years with a state budget line item and of $2,500 per year. But basically, it was to grow medicinal plants, and then you can see some of the staff working with a still that was right on site to extract interesting chemical components from these plants and so forth. So that was pretty neat. Arthur Yule was the next dean, who was most famous for leading change in pharmacy practice, but he was also a plant chemist person and continued that tradition. And David Perlman was a dean later in the sequence, but he brought microbial fermentation and that whole area of expertise in natural products to the school in a big way. So obviously there were many, many faculty involved too, but it was, I think, helped along greatly by the leadership of the school over the years. So we do stuff in plant area. We do microorganisms, and one of our newest faculty hires is a marine natural products expert. And the techniques have altered a bit over the years, where we use fancy techniques like biochemical genetics in new ways. We still rely on time-treasured techniques like fermentation and do a lot of lead compound isolation and then identification, which requires incredible technical work and lots of equipment and instrumentation and so forth. And then have also added more recently a more true synthetic organic flavor to assist the people who are isolating and identifying things and also creating new molecules all on their own. So just a couple examples. I told you we're going to get some chemistry today, but there won't be a quiz afterwards, so no worries. But this is a picture of a soil microbe, and of course microbes are all around us, and they're so interesting pharmaceutically because they are in constant warfare with each other. So they put out all kinds of interesting things to ward off their neighbors. And can we use those chemicals to our benefit? Well, the answer is, to a large extent, yes. So this is just a cool little picture of a soil microbe. And Dr. Ben Shen on our faculty is an expert in soil microbes and focuses on really unique source from the Yunnan province in China. And it's been estimated that only 1% of the soil microbes on the planet have ever been touched. They're difficult to culture sometimes. They're cranky. They don't like to grow for you, so you have to learn how to work with them. But in any case, what Ben does is to deconstruct the biochemical machinery that the microbes use to create a particular interesting natural product and put it together and put it back together in such a way as to allow the microbe to produce mass quantities of the single compound of interest. So that's pretty cool, I think. But I don't know how he does that. Back to the foxglove, and John Thorson on our faculty is an expert in sugar chemistry. And many of these natural products are decorated with various sugars, glucose, fructose, all the oses. They're all the sugars. And what John Thorson has been able to do is to re-engineer again the biochemical production mechanisms to alter the nature and the position that sugars are attached to various molecules, and that has completely altered the pharmaceutical and toxicological profile of many of these drug molecules, which is pretty interesting too. And Tim Buny is our new natural products guy, and he works with primarily sponges, which an example is on the left there, and even more interestingly, the microbes that live within the sponge are getting more and more interesting in terms of what are they producing and throwing out into the environment, let alone the sponge. And on the right is an example of an ascidian, a marine animal, that really, for whatever reason, produce all kinds of cool molecules. So he's studying those things. And Dr. Richard Shung and Wai-Ping Tang are our synthetic chemists that work together with the other members of this area and say, well, what do you need to make your fancy compound? And so they develop synthetic methods that permit the synthesis of the target molecule or relatives thereof to see if we can optimize the lead compound that was originally found in the plant or animal. So that's kind of the whole thing. And we're leading up to the launch of the Wisconsin Center for Natural Products Research out of the school, which is going to be awesome. So we're not ready for prime time quite yet, but that's pretty cool. So I did want to spend a few minutes jumping to a related area of herbal medicines, and that is functional foods. The ones we talked about earlier, foxglove and Taxol and so forth, are certainly not plants that you would normally ingest in your diet. But there's a number of examples of agents of plants that cross the food to drug boundary. And those are particularly interesting, I think. And this functional food term has come about kind of in everyday vocabulary these days, but it's foods with an added health benefit beyond their traditional nutritive value. And these, of course, come from specific chemical components in those food products, which are referred to by many names. Again, we like to confuse ourselves. Nutraceuticals, phytochemicals, and so forth. And even down to the point now where people are engineering food products to either maximize the content of an interesting constituent for health or engineering them from scratch, really. So there's these designer foods that are quite interesting. And, of course, this does get back to Hippocrates and his very famous quote about let your food be your medicine. So how does this fit into the whole picture here? Well, again, there's many, many examples of plants that cross this food-drug barrier. I already mentioned briefly garlic, which is one. I mean, there's thousands. I just brought a couple nice pictures. Red grapes and red wine and the resveratrol content that you keep hearing about, the medicinal purposes. Yeah, I like to talk about red wine and chocolate, and that's maybe why people come. The carotenoids, the beta-carotene in carrots and related species. Lycopene is another carotenoid in tomatoes, finding very interesting activity against prostate cancer. Turmeric. The curcumin in turmeric is a very powerful antioxidant, very interesting medicinal properties in addition to its culinary uses. Green tea, you don't go anywhere without falling over green tea these days, right? Highly, highly antioxidant, very, very interesting from a health benefit standpoint. I put in the pomegranate here because the seminal work on pomegranate has been done here at UW-Madison, so in conjunction with the School of Pharmacy. So I always like to put in a plug for that. And here we are, two of my personal favorites, caffeine and chocolate. And while I do give entire lectures about chocolate, I will refrain from doing that today. But the point is that I always pass around samples when I lecture about chocolate, so I have some goodies for you. I have not nearly enough, so don't fight over them. But I'll have Susan try and get these sort of distributed, and maybe you'll have to share with your neighbors. So I bring you the health of chocolate. Okay, so I've been alluding to the regulatory situation several times, and so I just wanted to point out the main features of the legislation. So a lot of people will say that the herbal medicine and dietary supplement industry is unregulated, and that is not correct. It is stupidly regulated, but it is not unregulated. So the main features, and the reason that I know so much about this, is that the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994 was crafted by Senator Orrin Hatch within the Utah delegation, which is where I was living at the time and involved with this industry, and it was wild. It was just totally amazing time. So anyway, DSHE, as it's called, does several things. First, it defined dietary supplements. This word had been thrown around and used, but never defined. So it was defined as products which include vitamins, minerals, herbs, or other botanicals, amino acids, and other dietary substances taken to supplement the diet by increasing total dietary intake. Do you feel more informed? Now, I'm sure there's some lawyers, and I know there's lawyers in the audience, that might be able to translate this for the rest of us, but I have a lot of problems with this definition. One is it just cycles around in some unproductive way. The other is that I think it's really done a disservice to all of the various categories that are covered, because we're trying to do a very different thing with a multivitamin than we are by taking echinacea. Right. So why group them together in this awkward way? The other thing is that the supplementing the diet idea, again, not all these products and not all plants have any nutritive value whatsoever. So you're not going to be out sprinkling valerian on your salad. It's just not a food product. So why do we have to use this dietary business? I just don't get it. So I have some problems with this, but this was a huge victory for the dietary supplement industry that they had a definition. So somebody was happy about it. It did place the burden of proof on the FDA for safety, and that may seem logical at the outset, but the bottom line is, the problem is that it did not place any burden on any manufacturer. So it's up to the FDA to go back and prove all these problems, which has been quite difficult, even in instances where things were very, very obvious and clear-cut. So that's out of whack. It called for the establishment of good manufacturing practices for dietary supplements, and finally, we have some movement on that. In 2007, it took 13 years to come to any grips with even an attempt at product quality, and it's still pretty feeble. The other feature of DSHE is that it changed the labeling on these products. Previous to DSHE, there had been many changes in how these things had been labeled, but most recently, all you could have on the bottle was the name of the plant, period, which doesn't provide much background or information. So the legislation was intended to provide additional information to consumers. So you could now have structure function claims on the bottles, which indicates some impact on the structure or function of the body. But you could not have therapeutic claims, because, of course, they're not drugs, right? They're right, plant products. So I keep talking about echinacea, one of my favorites. So you would hunt around on the bottle and see the structure function claim that promotes well-being in the cold and flu season. Now, don't we want well-being all the time? I mean, why do we have to wait for the cold and flu season? And does that give you any indication that this contains quite powerful immune stimulants? Not all patients should be taking this. No one should take it for very long, because the immune system gets used to it and downregulates its own production, and it's a really bad situation. No, because of course that would be too drug-like, and we can't talk about those things. And then even better, there's an asterisk, and you hunt around, and you always have the disclaimer that this statement has not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Well, I ask you why we're all buying them, then. I'm really confused about this, but this is the FDA's disclaimer. So does this give you more information? I don't know. I particularly like the lines that have been drawn. For example, back to garlic. You can find products that state maintains healthy cholesterol. And that's a structure function claim. But you can't say lowers cholesterol, because that's a drug claim. Okay, talk about confusion. Anyway, that's where we find ourselves. So my main points, again, are that there is no proof of efficacy required for marketing these products. You need to know that. And again, there's more research coming up about it, but it's really in the lap of the consumer to find all that, figure it all out, and make informed choices. There's also no proof for safety required before marketing. I think that takes a lot of people by surprise. And again, the adverse events are often ignored, and this is well known, and simply overlooked because these are natural, right? And so people wouldn't connect any adverse event with an herbal medicine product. And that's not good. So this is a busy slide, but it just shows the different regulations that apply to prescription drugs, over-the-counter, and dietary supplements. And you can see, with no exceptions, the prescription and OTC are highly regulated and similarly regulated, and the dietary supplement category is not. And it ends up where they're treated more like foods than like drugs, and I have a problem with that. So just so you know, again, what you're getting into. And I'm not saying that some of these things aren't great and that there are not great manufacturers out there. There are. There are some really good companies, really good products, but it gets lost in the noise of all this unnecessary wacko regulations and so forth, in my view. So the big movement in 2007 in product quality and content was that the FDA issued, after 13 years, outlining what was going to be necessary in order to now market dietary supplements, including all these wonderful things that I've been hammering on for years, identity, purity, strength, composition of the raw materials and the products. Duh. Labeling must be accurate. Duh. It's just, anyway, so this has now been going for 3 years, and I haven't heard a peep about anything. Visits by the FDA, any audits, I don't know where it stands, but I guess their heart was in the right place, but I don't think it's been implemented in any real way. And again, it's necessary to know that even though the regulations are increased, we think, it's closer to food than to any drug sort of regulation. So the bottom line is buyer beware. You're experimenting on yourself, and I'm not saying that that's not good or interesting, but we continue to have quality and content problems that really need to be resolved, because unless we know what's in the bottle, we can't talk intelligently about safety and efficacy. We just can't. So really frustrating. And these are medicines. They're not miracles. They're not the magic bullet that means you don't have to exercise and et cetera, et cetera. That's just not how it works. Natural does not mean harmless. If there's one message I can leave you with, that would be it. And we can have dramatic side effects with these products for some interesting reasons. This is not, Aunt Sally making tea on the porch anymore. This is big time business, high potency, different preparation methods, and just because ginkgo used to be done in a certain way, it's very different now, and we have to look at it differently. And, of course, we're all very good at polypharmacy. We take all sorts of things all at the same time, and we have to really worry about herbal medicines in that mixture, just like we would any constellation of prescription or over-the-counter medications. The dietary intake versus supplementation thing is fascinating to me, and I don't have an answer for you. But my favorite example is increasing tofu content in the diet, got a little tofu, versus taking a supplement that's based on a particular constituent isolated from tofu that is thought to be medically interesting. Well, do you know how much tofu you would have to eat to equal this bottle of supplements? It's like 5,000 pounds or something. And so maybe that's okay, but I'm not sure. So do we supplement our diet modestly with the food product, or do we go to isolated chemical constituents from that food product? Or even you'll find broccoli in a bottle, right? Okay, well, there it is. Everybody can take broccoli tablets, but, you know, still doesn't sound very palatable, does it? Anyway, that's a really interesting question. So I do believe that with proper study, common sense regulation, that herbal medicines and other dietary supplements have a place. We're certainly not there yet, but we just have to, again, get our little common sense test up a little bit. And what I would urge you to do is keep the lines of communication open with your healthcare providers, physicians, and pharmacists, so they know if you are, in fact, taking any type of this sort of product along with others. And so don't hide that. Nobody's going to laugh at you, or they better not. And that used to be a real big problem in people's disclosure of their use of these products. But so don't do that. Tell people what you're taking, because it does matter. So with that, I wanted to share with you just a couple of websites and other information for where to turn. The Herbalgram on the bottom there I found to be incredibly useful. It comes out 3 or 4 times a year. I brought some copies for you to page through if you'd like. I think it's $25 or something, quite reasonable, from the American Botanical Council. And I have found it to be incredibly useful in keeping up on regulatory issues, new research snippets, and other things, and would highly recommend, actually, this publication to anyone interested in keeping up to date on this sort of thing. So, Susan, you want to pass these around just randomly, and people can page through them a bit while we're finishing up. So with that, I'd like to open the floor for questions or comments. I always love people's personal stories and so forth. So any yes, sir. Right. Yeah, the question dealt with how few physicians and practitioners have really bothered with this, and we have a group of, not just here, but everywhere, of quote-unquote integrated medicine sort of folks like Dave Raichel here on campus. And, well, I would hope that that's the direction that things are moving in. And I think, again, pharmacy could have embraced the product end of this with greater enthusiasm. But really, when it all started, it was always poo-pooed as not useful and not helpful, and physicians just didn't really want to mess with it, or pharmacists. And so it was kind of pushed to the side, while at the same time as consumer interest and use was exploding. And that's not a good mixture. So I would hope to think that there will be a lot more of this integrated thinking moving forward. We just have to do it that way. Sir. The question dealt with the recent news story is that multivitamins really aren't necessary, and that diet really can take care of most things. And I have to use myself as an example, I guess, and my not so good diet. So I do take a multivitamin, but there's so many cases where these products of various kinds, whether it's a herbal or a vitamin, basically gives you really expensive urine. And so that, you know, you just kind of have to, again, use your common sense and gauge your own diet and so forth. But, you know, and the variety of the foods that we eat now is extraordinarily different than in previous years, as well as the growth of the local and seasonal sort of eating that Madison and other places are very, very famous for. So without having any basis for, like I was diagnosed with a vitamin D deficiency last winter. Well, that's pretty strong evidence that I need to do something, but as a rule, I don't know that it's terrifically helpful, especially at the levels that you find normally in a multivitamin, which are very small and probably not, can't get rid of a deficiency even if you had one. So, yeah. Yeah, the question was things like vitamin C and how different is it to take a highly purified supplement versus a more complete form of a fruit or vegetable that contains vitamin C. And really, that's a really good question. The molecule itself is, of course, the same. It's the same chemical. But is there, are there constellations of other related or unrelated chemicals within a particular food product that cause differentiation in absorption or distribution or something? And that is probably correct, largely. It hasn't been studied a lot, but now we're getting more into, it's funny to watch this cycle around from, oh, we have to follow the pharmaceutical model and isolate one thing that has all the answers, to, well, maybe it's the mixture and maybe it's how we make it and so forth. So it's going to be hard to generalize, but I think there's evidence for that being completely true with other things around the particular agent of interest contributing in some way. Yes. Absolutely. If you got any of the ones rolling around, you'll see that they are all dark chocolate. And this depends on the percentage of cacao. So if you go, I don't think there's anything real about milk chocolate. That's my bias. But if you go to the store and look for chocolate products that have a high cacao content, that's when you really get into it. Now, you have to work up to it. I mean, if you get up into the 80% realm, it's virtually inedible to me. I'm working on it. Practice a lot. 70% I'm okay with. And really, you don't want to get below 60% cacao or you're just into the Snickers kind of area. And then you got to worry about fat and calories besides. So the higher cacao content is what you need to look for, and really, the higher the better. And that's where you start getting the antioxidant capacity. Yes, over here. Really good question. Dealing with the outright fraudulent practices that are rampant in the industry. Well, I'd like to think that any pharmacist or pharmacy that carried these products would do due diligence in terms of the background of the products that they're buying. There are some excellent companies out there that make quality products based on scientific research, and you just have to find them. I don't think we're ever going to get rid of the internet ad for whatever, memory things that aren't based on much of anything outside of wanting to sell a product. But the problem with the situation is that you have to be so careful about that and really take responsibility a lot of times as a consumer to try and figure that out, and it's not very easy to do. But again, I'd like to think in any retail environment that the sellers would do that background and not go with anything that isn't based on rigorous scientific study. One more question, right here, ma'am? I always get myself into trouble with this question. Not so much here as in Utah, because there's so many more and there's so many more bad ones. But I will mention one locally. Because it's a Wisconsin company, and I think the world of how they do things, and that's Enzymatic Therapy out of Green Bay. So Enzymatic Therapy out of Green Bay. So write that one down, and then all the other companies can come screaming that I didn't mention them. So I believe so. I have some of their community pharmacy on, yeah. Well, they're the, you know, the center of the universe there. So before I let you go, I want to just do one more piece of business, and that is to bring you up to speed on a campus initiative that we're all involved in. And I know you're committed members of the Bascom Hill Society have done so much for the campus, and I thank you for those efforts to date and what you have planned. But this is so special. I just didn't want to miss an opportunity to make sure you knew about the Great People Scholarship program that is ongoing. And this is a demonstration of the UW-Madison dedication to academic excellence. And it is an extension or a response, I guess, to the shifting in funding sources to the university, where we have tax dollars, we have tuition money, and we have private gifts. And those are really the three sources. The state is doing everything they can, and it's amazing what public resources have gone into creating this incredible institution. The tuition situation from students, they're stepping up too, and now we're bringing all of the partners up to a higher level in that triad. And this came out largely of Chancellor Martin's Madison Initiative for Undergraduates, which you may have heard about, that was actually the students voted to add a tuition differential to themselves to cover this. So you can tell you how meaningful this is to the campus. And part of that money is dedicated for special needs, fixing bottleneck courses and adding faculty in helpful places and redoing our advising systems and all sorts of things like that. And another chunk of it is dedicated to meeting, for the first time, unmet financial need for many, many of our students. We fall so short in this category that it's really awful. It's really awful. So what we're trying to do is increase the pool of scholarship funds that we have to ensure access and affordability for all qualified students, regardless of their socioeconomic standing and background. And that's what the Great People Scholarship is all about. So the idea is to raise the same number of dollars through private giving as is available from the Madison Initiative for Undergraduates. And that's the sort of covenant that we've made with the students and others. And so we're all engaged in this process of raising those funds. And it's helped enormously by the UW Foundation's partnership, because they're matching gifts to this Great People Scholarship. And if one comes into a particular school, in pharmacy we've established 6 or 7 Great People Scholarships for pharmacy students, and that's matched 50 cents to the dollar. But if the gift comes into the greater campus community for freshmen, sophomores, and so forth, they will match dollar for dollar. So I don't know how incredibly more support we can ask for from our partner, the UW Foundation. But I just wanted to make sure that you were aware of this huge, big, very big, transformative effort that we have ongoing across campus. And I would ask that you join all of us in making this a reality. So thanks for being here today, and on Wisconsin.